Wait a minute, this sounds like rock and or roll.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ. And for today's episode, I am once again joined by author and historian Greg Renoff, author of the upcoming book Van Halen Rising, about the early years of Van Halen. And for today's episode, we thought it would be fun to talk about the phenomenon of Van Hagar, when Sammy Hagar replaced David Lee Roth as frontman, lead vocalist for Van Halen. And a lot of people, myself included, had a really negative reaction to Sammy Hagar in Van Halen. And so Greg and I tried to figure out why exactly so many people had a negative reaction to Sammy, and why the term Van Hagar is often used as a derogatory term. And we just talk about the differences between Sammy and David Lee Roth, and their different approaches, and what was different about the band Van Halen with each frontman. And then at the end of the episode, you'll get to hear us speculate about who Van Halen might have enlisted to replace David Lee Roth other than Sammy Hagar. So that's a lot of fun. So let's get right to it. This is my discussion about Van Hagar with Greg Renoff. I don't know when was the first time that I heard the phrase Van Hagar, but I know as soon as I heard it, it seemed so obvious, and like it was just sitting there waiting for someone to say it, you know, and it was just perfect because to a lot of people, I guess, and to me, it just wasn't Van Halen, and to have a different name for it. And also, I think most of the time, especially back then when you heard someone say Van Hagar, it had negative connotations, you know, it wasn't a term of endearment, I don't think. I think it was a lot of people were looking for something to call it, and that was just so perfect.
Right. You know, and I think too, that one of the things that is, when I think about, for example, with Deep Purple, right, when Deep Purple loses Ian Gillan, they get an unknown guy, Coverdale, and they get Glenn Hughes, who had been in Trapeze, but certainly wasn't some sort of high profile rock star. And so there really wasn't this previous career that these guys had. And I always thought that Hagar had sort of a chip on his shoulder about that. I think, you know, that Hagar somehow, in my opinion, has overstated his influence as a solo musician before his time in Van Halen. Now, I'm not saying he didn't have a career that was moderately successful. You know, the heavy metal soundtrack, I've Done Everything for You, what he ended up writing for Rick Springfield, and well, ended up recorded by Rick Springfield. It wasn't as if Sammy had a unsuccessful solo career, but if you read Sammy's book, there's these stories that I find somewhat hard to believe about how, you know, these arena tours were doing so well and stuff like that. And, you know, to me, Sammy was always sort of a moderately successful B-list vocalist slash band leader. Then he comes into Van Halen, and he has this sort of ego issue with Roth. And Roth clearly had his ego issues with Hagar. And that's why I always think, when I think back, if they had brought someone on board who was more of an unknown who could have, you know, could have handled the gig, there would have been less of the bullshit with, oh, I don't want to sing Roth songs. When right. I sing Jump, I'm going to half-ass it because I don't really like the songs, which is what kind of went on live and when I saw them. I mean, I really got the impression that Sammy was not at all interested in singing the Roth era songs.
And I don't think he could pull off the Roth era songs because there's so much performance element to those songs that Sammy just either wasn't capable of doing or wouldn't do.
Right.
And I think that's what he didn't like about David Lee Roth is he didn't get the performance aspect of it. He it's like it's as if he was disliking an actor for a character they played in a movie.
Right.
Is what he did to David Lee Roth, because David Lee Roth on stage was obviously a character. And I guess either you get it or you don't, or you like it or you don't. But the way Sammy Hagar acted as if the David Lee Roth you saw on stage was the actual person seems like he was missing a whole element there. And, you know, Sammy Hagar never really was a performer in that way at all.
No, no.
I mean, I think personality-wise, he's pretty much the opposite of David Lee Roth. Like, well, he's at all obnoxious or flamboyant. He's like a macho, manly man, and he would have been embarrassed to act like David Lee Roth. He didn't have that kind of, that gene, that performance gene, I guess.
Yeah, and I think, too, I think as history has shown is that, you know, Hagar, for whatever you want to say about him, has proven to be a guy who's generous about his willingness to share the spotlight with people. And go out there, and you know, I always kind of think that in later years, Sammy has sort of, for all of its self-serving self-promotion, that you know, Sammy's willing to share the stage with anybody, and so you know, Roth is sort of this guy who was just, he's a performer. He wants the spotlight. He wants it on him, and that's sort of when they toured together. Was that 01 or 02, whenever that tour was? I always thought it was Roth made a mistake in refusing to go on stage with Sammy. He should have just done it. So it didn't look like he was, quote unquote, afraid to go on stage with Sammy. There was all that,
right,
you know, back and forth. I mean, I think that was really, in retrospect, a big mistake that Dave made. I actually lowered my estimation of him because I always thought, you know, Roth is like this guy, like, okay, you know, I'll scale the mountain for the Skyscraper album cover, even though I'm afraid of heights. You know, I'll jump off these stage, you know, risers over and over again, which probably destroyed his knees and his ankles, I'm sure, over the years doing that. You know, he was sort of this sort of larger than life superhero type figure. And then to see like he wouldn't come out and like, I don't know what, play a Humble Pie song with Michael and Sammy, whatever, they play 30 Days in the Hole or whatever. I mean, Whatever it would have been, like, I'm thinking, why do that?
If you're David Lee Roth, wouldn't your attitude just be screw that guy because Sammy has been such an asshole to him in the press for so long?
Yeah, but if he's such an asshole, why'd you tour with him?
Yeah, ka-ching, right?
Yeah, right. But I mean, it's like that's my point. It's not like Sammy's like, I'm having my Cabo Wabo bash down in Mexico. Come down, Dave, and sing with me. It's like they're on the same tour. I don't know. It just to me, it wasn't Roth's shining moment, I think. Yeah, I mean, I understand that Sammy and Dave had this quote-unquote feud, which interestingly enough, early on, if you look back at some of the articles that came out, this is like 86, 85, when this was just all sort of ramping up, Ross seemed to be embracing it. He would say, you know, this is all pro wrestling trash talk.
Yeah.
But, you know, but later on, it sort of, I think as Ross's career began to struggle and Van Halen continued to be an A-list arena size band up into the 90s, that really something changed with Roth's attitude about all that. Like, it wasn't so funny anymore when he wasn't playing arenas, he was playing sheds, and then he's playing state fairs.
Well, yeah, and then eventually David Lee Roth became like the butt of the joke so often, and his whole image just, you know, so drastically changed in the mainstream. I don't really know why. I mean, you know what I mean? He just kind of became a joke.
No, I definitely do.
And,
I think he just got lost. I mean, I think along the way, you know, there's this, he was this, it's sort of like if you're, I don't know what would be an example with an actor, you know, if you're Marlon Brando, right, and you're this handsome, swashbuckling actor who can play in On the Waterfront and all these other movies, you know, later in life when you look like he did in Apocalypse Now, you can't play that role anymore, right? You can't play that early role. And Roth got caught in the middle of that, and he kind of struggled with what to do with himself. He did the Mambo Slammer stuff and the Vegas thing. And, you know, to me, that the other thing to think about with Roth is that in researching and writing the book, you know, Roth really, first and foremost, is an entertainer. And he just loved being on stage most of all. I think that was what it was. And I've always said this, that I think if the Van Halen brothers hadn't come along and Roth had been, you know, in a different time and place, Roth's in, I don't know, Tijuana, Mexico, you know, he would have been in some sort of flamenco band where there would have been this flamboyant, you know, dancer vocalist in the front. I mean, he just wanted to perform. And so when I saw him singing, was in front of in Boston, at the Boston Pops, he did California Girls in front of that, with that huge orchestra. I mean, to me, if you watch that video of him, and everyone should look it up and watch it on YouTube, he is just beaming in a way, even the transcends his sort of Van Halen beaming. I mean, it just seemed like this was to him was like the greatest thing ever, right? There's 100,000 people. He's singing California Girls a jump. There's this huge orchestra. You know, I think to him that was like the great, right? This is like the greatest entertainment possible. There's everything is oversized, huge. Again, he was sort of in that huge spotlight.
Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for David Lee Roth.
And then if you watch that video you're talking about and you picture Sammy Hagar sitting in the audience laughing and snickering and shaking his head, because that's what he'd be doing, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I always felt this element of, for lack of a better word, like homophobia coming from Sammy Hagar toward David Lee Roth. Like,
right.
And he actually comes right out and says it in his book. He says he hated David Lee Roth, and he says that he thought he acted gay.
But I hated Dave. That guy rubbed me wrong. I'm sure I rub all kinds of people wrong, so it's not like I'm putting him down. The guy was a great front man, great attitude in rock, and he had an image from hell. But I just couldn't stand the guy. He was the opposite of what I believed in and what I am. First of all, the guy's not a great singer, and he acts like he's the coolest, hottest guy in the world, when to me, he looks gay. The guy was never believable to me.
He actually uses the word gay in his book.
Yeah.
And so so David Lee Roth is on stage doing a glam rock performance, playing the role of a rock star. And Sammy Hagar is watching that thinking, oh, he looks gay. Because he just doesn't get it in the end. He doesn't get it.
Right.
And, you know, that's just such stupidity.
Well, and the other thing that's interesting, too, is that I don't know, but I don't think chicks came to look at Sammy. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
I mean, I think one of the things that was brilliant about the persona that Roth created was that he was able to create this sort of man's man, like for all the spandex and all the other stuff, like a man's man. I'm going to drink Jack Daniels and do this incredible leap off a drum riser that, you know, no one can even imagine doing, and all these sword moves on stage when I saw him in 1984. You know, but yet on the other hand, chicks are going to go berserk, and they did. I mean, anyone who doesn't recognize that now is missing the point. I mean, the girls didn't come to see Sammy. You know, they just weren't like, oh, here's, you know, chicks went berserk for Roth. And they, you know, I think Eddie too, to some extent. I think a lot of he had a big following among women too, but it was that was part of the appeal. So I don't really get the whole, you know, and Sammy says Roth is gay. I mean, I don't get the whole, you know, if Sammy's uptight about that, I guess that says something about Sammy.
Well, Sammy is too much of a manly man to ever go on stage and do anything that anyone might interpret as gay.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
He's afraid of that, basically, if you break it down, because he just has this attitude about it that... But how can you be a performer in rock and roll if you're just going to be reserved and, you know, bore? I mean, really, what? In the end, Sammy Hagar is just kind of boring.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and maybe we could get into this a little bit later. I mean, some people know that I'm a huge fan of the first Montrose record. You know, I certainly bought and listened to all the Van Halen albums with Hagar. And I mean, I think that's what I was trying to say earlier about Hagar's solo career. He was always like a, you know, like a mid-level guy. I mean, it was like no one, I don't know, but I don't think a lot of people were big Sammy Hagar fans. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like let's say the late 70s, early 80s. That's not a huge knock on Sammy. I mean, he had a successful career as a solo artist. I mean, he made albums and he toured, and you know, you can't knock that. But it wasn't like anyone was like, you know, I'm wearing my Sammy Hagar shirt to school after I saw Sammy Hagar in concert in 1982 because I want to feel like a badass. I mean, I think, you know, that went on with a lot of other bands, as we know, you know, the Iron Maidens, the Judas Priests, the Van Halens, the Rushes. There was sort of that loyalty from fans. I don't think that Sammy had that type of I mean, he didn't.
No.
As far as I know.
I was just really getting into music at this time when Sammy Hagar joined.
Right.
I was 11 and 12 in 85, 86. So this was right when I was really starting to get into music. And I know I liked Van Halen, probably got into Van Halen not long before Sammy Hagar came on the scene.
Right.
But I could still remember my reaction to Sammy Hagar just being really negative. And so I've been trying to think about why. I know a lot of other people had the same reaction too. He just turned a lot of people off, I think. And I mean, the obvious thing is just because he couldn't have been more different than David Lee Roth, for one thing, just personality wise. And I was thinking about, like, when he first joined Van Halen, he had this like short, curly, bleached hair. I mean, I wrote down that he looked and dressed like a beach bum. You know, that's kind of like his image was. And he was just always smiling, but just had like no personality. You know, David Lee Roth was all personality.
Right.
And Sammy Hagar would just like sit there and grin with his beach bum hair. And, you know, and I don't know, he just was kind of a bore. And I think there's something about his voice that a lot of people don't like, too. I mean, he does have a good singing voice, but for some reason, I just don't like it.
Right.
I think, you know, he has range, obviously, but in a way, his voice is just kind of flat. I think it lacks personality. His voice does, too, I think.
Yeah, I don't have so much of an issue with his voice. To me, when I, you know, I was 14, and I saw Van Halen in 1984 and became this huge fan. And, you know, when they toured together again, I was... one thing that was really, I remember very distinctly being inside the Meadowlands. This is in July of 1986 in Burn and Burn. They played four nights, I think, at the Meadowlands. They're sold out. I was, and I was like, wow, they played four nights and they only played two in Roth toured. And there was a huge, you know, at that point, Van Halen was, building, you know, living off the legacy, I think, a little bit of 1984. I mean, they were the biggest band in the world and rock band in the world in 1984. And then so 86, they tour again. I just remember standing in the audience. I've told the story before. And, you know, Sammy holds up this sign that says Dave sucks or something and shows it to Michael or something. And they kind of snicker and shows it to Eddie. And he kind of tips his head back kind of theatrically like he's laughing. And I'm thinking, well, what's that about? Like, why are you making fun of Dave? And, like, this is kind of before, I think, the feud was going on. But it wasn't like there was this sort of, like, Dave hates Sammy part of pop culture. Like, it wasn't like, you know, like it is today, like embedded in the pop culture. And I was just sort of like, that's... stupid. I think I had seen Roth at this point already, and Roth didn't do that, right? And I'm thinking to myself, like, what's the need to trash Dave? And as a Van Halen fan who got turned on to Van Halen from the Roth era, I was turned off to that immediately. And the other thing that you know, I think over time, and even at the time, I, you know, Roth for all the sort of, you know, I'm stoned, I'm drunk party shtick, which a lot of it is, I think, of the way Roth presented himself on stage. You know, Roth's lyrics were much more clever than Sammy's. Yeah. And again, Sammy Hagar, as the frontman of Van Halen, was wildly successful. They had a great career together. The songs did really well on the radio. They sold a ton of albums. They toured. I mean, I get it, right? But the lyrics to me are just, you know, like Summer Nights, like, you know, I won't go through the lyrics, but if you read those lyrics, they're just not – They lack something of the cleverness and the intellect that Roth brought to his lyrics. Even the lyrics of
also,
Panama.
Also, the darkness. There was a lot of like darkness and yeah, there was a lot going on with David Lee Roth's lyrics. And yeah, you're right. There's nothing going on with Sammy Hagar's run of the mill, you know, cookie cutter lyrics. So
yeah, and the other thing too was the sort of, it's interesting, you know, as a teenager, I think a lot of men, you know, you don't want to be tied down and in love, right? At 15, you know, that's not really what life is about. It might be for some guys, but you know, if you have a steady girlfriend, but for a lot of young men, you're sort of out there playing the field, and it's like this high school, and you know, you're all about checking out the girls, and then also, I mean, songs were about, it seemed to me like the hit songs were about love, you know, when it's love, how will I know, you know, this is sort of their Love Walks In. It was this very, I don't know what the word was. It was just mature. It was much more of a mature. Right. And of course, Sammy was in his probably in his early 40s then, or late 30s.
He was, yeah, he was 38 when he joined.
Okay, so he's in his late 30s. And, you know, I get it, right? That's a different, he's in a different stage of his life. But Roth seemed to understand, right, that you can, he, even when Roth did write about love, like he wrote it in Secrets and these other songs that were, you know, about love or something to do with that, he knew how to couch it in a way that didn't make somebody feel like, you know, oh, you know, I'm gonna be tied down for the rest of my life with some chick, you know. Yeah, it's like, that's not like that wasn't my mindset at 16. I wasn't thinking like I gotta find a chick and like find out how I know what's love and it'll last forever. I was like, you know, no, that's not what I'm about at all.
Yeah, Roth wasn't talking about love.
right exactly. And when he did, you know, it was done in a way. He just had a different and a much more, I think, I hate this word, but nuanced way of doing it that didn't seem so, you know, like, so this is love and like, you know, again, like that's about love, right? But it's not like about I'm in love for the rest of my life with one girl when we get to walk down the aisle. I mean, even like, you know, How I Know When It's Love, the introduction of it, and that's, again, I know Eddie wrote the music, but it's almost like a wedding march. It's like, da, 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 da. Like, you could see someone walking down the aisle to it. Like, that to me, you know, I don't know, that just to me was a flaw in their approach, and they immediately, to me, came off more like Foreigner in a lot of ways. And again, that wasn't their output wasn't all like that. I get that. I mean, you know, Sammy tried to write his sex songs and stuff like that, like Black and Blue and In and Out, and I just don't think they were too obvious, and they weren't quite as, I just don't think they came off as well as the Roth era songs. Roth knew how to write about sex in a way that wasn't quite as straightforward and obvious.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It seems like Eddie Van Halen gets all the credit for writing the songs, and people forget that, as far as I know, David Lee Roth wrote all the melodies, I think. I think he took the music that Eddie Van Halen came up with and then wrote lyrics and a melody over it. So obviously that's a huge part of the songwriting. And, you know, if you gave the music of Ain't Talking About Love to Sammy Hagar, what would he have come up with?
Right.
It would have been something completely different. So, I mean, and yeah, you know, so David Lee Roth wrote great melodies and great lyrics. And I think that's kind of lost on a lot of people.
And I don't want to beat this point to death, but another song that came to mind, another, when you said melodies, like Dance the Night Away has such a great, I mean, it's a pop song, right?
Yeah.
When I had my conversation with Templeman a couple of years ago, I was saying something about them being a heavy metal band, and he's like, they write great fucking pop songs. And he would, you know, and that's actually what he said to me. And he said, Eddie wrote these great fucking songs. And you know, he talked about Dance the Night Away, how that was just a pop gem, and he's right. But, you know, again, Roth is singing about love, but but it's not, it doesn't feel like, you know, like I'm chained to this woman. I don't know. It was to me, Roth seemed to understand, even as an older person, meaning even as he entered his, whatever, his early 30s, he wasn't 16 anymore, how to remain in touch with the mindset of their audience. You know, again, I don't know. Maybe that was, you know, that was also part of the appeal too. Like a lot more women probably liked. I know, just from my own extended family, that like a lot of, you know, that the 5150 was very successful. I think in a way too with a lot more women, right? That there was a little bit more of an opening up. People, you know, I imagine women who were turned off by Roth's overtly sexual, you know, flamboyance and sort of like, that's too much. Like, we're, you know, Sammy presented a safer, tamer version of Van Halen, which I think, I'll mention this. My wife and my sister-in-law often joke about how they used to listen to Survivor on the way to their swim meets, like via the Tiger, to get pumped up for swim meets. And they're, you know, they were whatever they were, 16 and 17. And then they look back on that. Obviously they can see this sort of the silliness of that in retrospect, but you know, they would listen to 5150, like, you know, like pull out the Survivor, pop in the 5150. They were putting in Fair Warning,
right?
They weren't going to put in, you know, Women and Children First on the way to swim meet.
So it's funny, in my memory, like if I had to say which came out first before I looked it up, I thought Eat 'Em and Smile came out before 5150, but actually 5150 came out in March of 86, and then Yankee Rose, the single, was released in June. But to me, David Lee Roth with that single really kicked their ass. I mean, that song is killer. And I don't think the whole album holds up anymore. Eat 'Em and Smile. I went back and listened to it, and it's not very good. And like, I was listening to the song Going Crazy and thinking, this song doesn't even make sense. It just doesn't even work.
Right.
But and then the songs that try to sound like Van Halen, like Knucklebone and stuff, they just don't have a good hook. It's not very good, but Yankee Rose is great. And, you know, for David Lee Roth to come out with that song, I mean, he was really kicking their ass, you know, right at that moment.
Right.
But, I mean, it obviously, they went on to eclipse him.
There's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, one thing that always comes to mind to me is that I've never been impressed with Vi's songwriting. You know, I think as a instrumental musician, yeah, right? But as I never thought that the songs that Vi came up with Roth, were particularly great.
Right.
I mean, I think that was part of the, and I don't know the full, I do know, I just heard an interview with Steve Stevens that apparently Steve Stevens was invited to audition for Roth's band by Templeman. Templeman, at that point, Stevens had done work for Warner Brothers, maybe on the Top Gun soundtrack. And before they settled on Steve Vai, I guess when they were trying to figure out who was going to be in Roth's band, Templeman called Steve Stevens and said, hey, you want to audition for the band? And it didn't, you know, I think he said, no, I'm committed to, I don't know if it was back with Idol or whatever. He had a previous commitment or he couldn't go forward with that. And I actually think, I mean, again, it's sort of revisionist history again, but, you know, to me, Steve Stevens is a better song, wrote better songs.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
with that, Billy Idol.
Yeah, that could have been. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah, if David Lee Roth had a better songwriter he was working with, yeah. Definitely my favorite David Lee Roth album is A Little Ain't Enough, which was the first one he did without Steve Vai. So.
Right. Yeah, that one's a little bit up and down too, but I think there's some great, there's some definitely some better songs, and I imagine that must have been a big disappointment to Roth that one didn't do better, because I actually think you're right. I think that A Little Ain't Enough is a better song than anything they had done in some of the previous albums. Maybe, you know, again, with the Inky Rose, you can say, and there's some other songs, but I think that that song is a classic David Lee Roth anthem, and the vocal performance in that album was really good, and the production was really good.
Yeah.
Guitar playing was really good. Well, too, the thing that I really think is telling about Eat 'Em and Smile is that that's Roth's vision, right? You can be sure that Roth called 98% of the shots for that record. I mean, I'm sure he worked with Temple, but Greg Bissonette wasn't going to stand up to Roth like the way Alex Van Halen might have stood up, definitely would stand up to Roth and say, you're wrong or whatever. So, you know, you have the Frank Sinatra song, you have these other components in there, the I'm Easy. So those covers and stuff, that's Roth's, you know, that was what Roth, I'm sure, wanted from, you know, I don't think anyone would have had that much of a say. And of course, the thing, too, is that there was a lot of tension with Eddie and Templeman, too, and which lets me believe that Templeman and Roth were, on 1984, were pretty keyed into each other, having a shared vision. And so, I mean, I think that's probably, what Roth wanted.
Well, yeah, and it's hugely significant that Templeman went with Roth, because here's the guy who produced Montrose, and also he had produced VOA, Sammy Hagar's last album, before he joined Van Halen.
Right.
And yet he went with Roth over Van Hagar. So that's pretty significant.
there's been some interesting articles that have come out, some in Classic Rock magazine, some on Ultimate Classic Rock, that talk about the... I think our friend Matt Wardlaw did one on Ultimate Classic Rock, where they talk about the real tensions that were there with Templeman and Eddie and Landy and all the stuff that went on in 1984. I think that relationship with Eddie was strained. I mean, Templeman never, when I talked to Templeman, he didn't make it, it sound like it was anything too serious in retrospect, but there was definitely this, after 1984, I think there was this sense that Eddie felt that he had been vindicated, like his vision for what he wanted his album to be like, as compared to Diver Down, I assume, had been vindicated. So I think, you know, I think he felt handcuffed by Templeman and Roth together. I definitely think that was what I took away from what I know and what I learned from talking to Templeman, that, you know, that relationship was just not the way it had been, where it had been a mentoring relationship in the very beginning. I think it was much more that Eddie felt that he wanted to have more of a, you know, a say on what he wanted to make in terms of music. And that makes sense. And that's why they brought in Mick Jones. And I assume Mick Jones was just a different person and would have less of a ability to basically, you know, stand up to Eddie and say, you know, I produced, I'm not saying that Templeman ever said this, but, you know, Templeman had obviously the track record with Van Halen to say, like, you know, I've guided you guys to 6 platinum records. I think I have the right to say this, and you should listen to me.
Well, I don't think that Ted Templeman could have produced both 50 and Enum and Smile, right? So do you think that it was up to Templeman to choose, or do you think that Eddie Van Halen didn't want him, so then he ended up with Roth? You know?
Yeah, and I think that's, I don't know for sure. I think that stuff is out there, isn't there? I think Templeman has given interviews where he's talked about that, and I don't remember what exactly he said, but my inkling is I think he went with, they're both Warner Brothers records, right? And so I think he went with Roth probably because that was where probably felt most welcome. And I'm going to guess, too, that probably Roth really wanted Templeman and right. Eddie probably really didn't.
Right.
Right. I think that's probably accurate, is that Roth very much would have wanted Ted Templeman. I mean, you know, Roth I read an old interview with Roth that was in some local newspaper where he said, you know, Teddy's an old song guy. Me and him sit around. This is like 1979. Me and Ted are old song guys. We sit around and we listen to stuff from Motown and stuff like that. I think they had Ted Templeman's an extremely smart guy, and I think Roth is too. They had a very encyclopedic knowledge of pop music from the 50s and 60s, and I think that they had this, you know, meeting of the minds that lasted. I think you can't blame Eddie for saying, I want to be free of this previous, you know, whatever it was, previous relationship with Templeman, that part of it was built around Roth's relationship with Templeman.
Yeah, and one thing I read basically implied that Eddie Van Halen wanted to produce 5150 himself, but the record label wouldn't let him.
Right.
And then that's when they brought in Mick Jones. So then probably Eddie Van Halen probably still did most of the production, and Mick Jones just sat there to make the record label happy, maybe. I don't know. I don't really like the songs on 5150. I think, in retrospect, now I think Why Can't This Be Love is a great song. I don't think I liked it at the time.
Right.
And I like Dreams, even though I really wish that Dreams would have been played on guitar instead of the synth. I've always kind of wished the same thing about Jump, or I would at least like to hear what Eddie Van Halen might have done with that song in 1984 if he played it on guitar instead of the synth. But I mean, obviously, Dreams has a great melody. But besides those two songs, I don't really like anything at all on 5150. I think a lot of it's really bad.
I don't go back and listen to it very often. There's some, like, even the song on 5150, which has a great solo, and, you know, everyone always talks about Eddie's live solo on 5150, and what from the New Haven MTV broadcast and things like that. But yeah, I don't think the songs. I mean, the other thing too I wanted to mention is that you touched on this earlier, DJ, is that if you came of age, if you were 14 in 1986, right, and you first discovered Van Halen with Sammy, it's a different deal. I mean, I think that's the thing too. It's part of it is there's the old phrase that, you know, your musical tastes are directly related to the first music you listened to when you had your first beer, you know, like, or whatever music you listened to when you had your first beer, that sort of coming of age is sort of a rebellious teenager or whatever. And so, you know, to me, I can't listen to 5150 without thinking about Fair Warning. I can't listen to 5150 without thinking about Van Halen 1. You know, again, for like I said, like my sister-in-law and my wife, it's a different deal. They didn't really, they're a little bit younger than me, and they didn't grow up listening to Roth era Van Halen. They were Sammy Hagar. You know, that was their Van Halen. And so, you know, they like those songs and they can sing along to them. I just don't think it even, but I think it's a rock album to me in my estimation. Right. Yeah, I think we're right. Eat 'em and Smile does not hold up as well as it should. And I don't think 5150 does particularly. I mean, I actually, out of all the Hagar era records that I actually think that probably For All Unlawful Carnal Knowledge probably holds up the best. I don't know. I mean, I don't, again, I don't regularly pull those records out and listen to them.
No, yeah, definitely. For All Unlawful Carnal Knowledge is the only one I actually bought back then. I bought that tape and I liked it. I think OU812 is pretty terrible as a record. That's just my opinion, but yeah, there's a lot of good songs on For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, especially Run Around and
right,
The Dream Is Over and Top of the World. Those are really good songs,
right? Yeah, I mean, I really think the whole Andy Johns production, too, to me, it was interesting because it was so – whatever happened with OU812, the production was not good.
No.
The engineer – I don't know what was going on, and I've heard different stories about the sort of the health and wellness of the people involved in making that record. I'll just leave it at that. But, I there's almost no bass on the record. It's just a very strange-sounding record. Even like Eddie's guitar sound is good, but it's nothing like, you know, it's nothing like it was even on 5150. It just doesn't sound as, I don't think it sounded as good. And I don't know what, yeah, I don't know what went on there. But again, that was a very, that was another, I think, number one record for them.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's,
yeah, I mean, big hit songs from it. I don't know why. OU812, it reminds me a lot of Theater of Pain, the Motley Crue album, where this huge band comes out with a record that you just can't believe they put something that mediocre out at that moment in their career, and it's like it was just thrown together just to get an album out there. That's how I always felt about Theater of Pain, too, that it,
right.
I mean, that it was just, there's almost nothing worthwhile there, but they just had to get that record out in the market because they knew it would sell, but then, you know, you make a better album and it'll sell more even. But
yeah.
It's just like they got to get something out there.
Well, to be a little contrarian here, I give credit because they were able, for all the flaws, right? They you know, Finish What You Started was a huge hit.
Yeah.
A huge hit. And, you know, I saw a funny tweet on Twitter the other day that someone said the definition of dad rock, the ultimate definition, is Finish What You Started by Van Halen. No one under the age of 40 likes that song, you know. And it's like, it's kind of true. Like, it was like, it was just a very mainstream rock song. The video was played like crazy. It was played on the radio a lot of crazy. Now again, when I turn on rock radio today, which is not all that often, but I listen, I never hear that song.
No.
And that's another thing that's really interesting, is that the Hagar era material has not sort of come to be defined as quote unquote classic Van Halen. I don't mean sort of like it's David Lee Roth makes classic Van Halen, but sort of the, what you would consider to be now the classic rock era, the 70s and 80s and early 90s. You don't hear very much Hagar stuff on the radio. You hear some, but it's not played as much in my estimation.
No.
No, not even close. Yeah, I mean, David Lee Roth era Van Halen is still just constantly on the radio. Well, I never really listen to the radio anymore, but I mean, you know, Van Halen was always one of the most played bands, and the Roth stuff, not the Hagar stuff.
Right. And then again, that's my point. It's like it didn't really have the legs, right? You don't hear, I mean, occasionally you'll hear stuff from, you'll hear 5150. That's what I feel like I hear the most on the radio is like 5150. But I never hear Top of the World on the radio. I never hear, Pound Cake on the radio.
No.
Songs that were moderately successful or too successful at their time. And that's what I'm saying. And this is a larger problem with the way rock radio is presented in general. It's sort of, they basically, they have all these algorithms. They figure out which songs people listen to the most without changing the channel or whatever the hell they do. And so they decide like, oh, we're only going to play these five Van Halen songs over and over again. But it's, that sort of long-term legacy, it seems to me, those like OU812 is sort of completely lost in the shuffle now. Like nobody's going to go back and be like, oh, we better start playing more stuff from OU812 on Rock 109 or whatever it is,
No, well, what the singles are When It's Love and Finish What You Started, and then was there even another hit from that album?
This is on OU812. Yeah. I'd have to go look.
I can't think of any. I mean, I think Black and Blue or something was a single, but yeah, I mean, they're not going to play When It's Love on the classic rock radio, so I guess the only option would be Finish What You Started.
which I think like I occasionally hear. Yeah, so Cabo Wabo. Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty much it. When It's Love, Finish What You Started, Black and Blue. So that was the Templeman wasn't involved in that one at all. It was Landy and Van Halen produced it. But to me, it just sounds really, the sound is really flat. And I think about, God, this is the same band that made albums that just absolutely thundered, like Fair Warning and Women and Children First. It really doesn't sound very, very powerful.
Yeah, so we both gave some thought to who Van Halen might have enlisted to replace David Lee Roth instead of Sammy Hagar at the time. And this was a lot of fun to think about. So what did you come up with, Greg?
Well, I kind of came up with some of the... It's really hard, actually, when you think about it. I said before we came on, I was saying that I think one of the problems that... I think we said this before we came on. One of the problems that Hagar faced was that, of course, he had had a previous career. And if they had brought an unknown on into the band, I think the whole idea of singing Roth era songs would have come off a lot better on stage, and it would have been less awkward and less sort of this, I'm doing this, but I don't really want to do this, which is, I always felt the way Sammy's vibe was. And it was sort of like, why bother doing, why bother doing You Really Got Me, or why bother doing Jump if you don't want to do it anyway? It's like, just listen, don't play it.
With all of the big hit songs they had, how could Van Halen go on tour and not do at least five or six of those Roth era songs?
Right. Right. Well, again, then that gets back to, I don't want to get us too sidetracked here, but that gets us back to the issue of the name, right? If they had kind of come out as Van Hagar, it would have been like, okay, it's a new band. This is a new chapter in our story, right? And where people would have been less, I don't think it would have hurt the band's success at all, actually. I mean, maybe a little bit with name recognition, maybe, but I think it would have been just as successful, or it would have been exactly the same, but there would have been less of that Roth era legacy hanging over. I actually think that if they had picked Patti Smyth, not a very creative choice, having a female singer might have really, kind of made it easier to transition to something new. And that's what I think what we're trying to get at here is that Van Hagar was a new band in such a way. It was like when Dio replaced Ozzy. It's a different band. Yeah. There was this very awkward transition between the two of them, and always this sort of looming tension that was always there. Patti Smyth, I really think she's got a great rock voice. The thing that I had always heard, and I think actually there's probably a shred of truth to this, that there was some sort of romantic involvement, whatever it was. I think Valerie Bertinelli has been pretty honest about they had some problems in their marriage, and there may have been some sort of attraction between Eddie and Patty as well too, and I don't know how that factored into the whole mix of things or whatever.
Right.
I don't think I'm speaking out of turn here. I'm sure this isn't going to be breaking news on Blabbermouth that I said this. But I don't know if that factored into it as well. But I think having a female singer would have been, again, would it have been accepted? I don't know, but I think it would have. She's a great singer. I think she would have sung all those songs in 5150 great, I think. And it would have, you know, been less of this sort of like, ugh. I would say there's just sort of this unpleasantness around the whole Roth Hagar thing. And I can't see Dave trashing Patti Smyth. I mean, I just couldn't have seen the same type of, it might have been more of a, you go your way, I go mine. And there's less of this sort of distaste.
It would have been a really bold and interesting choice for sure. And yeah. Nothing like that had ever been done before.
Right.
So yeah, it could have been really cool. Yeah.
What about the other name that came to mind, I thought, is Billy Squire. Now, again, that might have been the same type of problem.
Yeah, that's interesting, though, because his career by 85, his career was definitely on the decline.
Right. But great songwriter.
Yeah. That's a very interesting idea, voice. Yeah.
Very distinctive singing voice. I mean, you know, one of the things I always think about Billy Squire is you hear his voice and you know it's him. I mean, within like two verses, is that, I think a better lyricist than Sammy. And it may have provided a different sort of vibe. I mean, I don't think he would have been like throwing around his blonde mane up there and jumping around in his red pants. It would have been a different, if you ever see the way that Billy Squire performed, he was much more, he didn't have that same super athletic approach that, you know, Sammy tried to cultivate with the jumping around and the sort of running around and like, as with Roth, it would have been a different vibe. But I think, I think it would have been somebody who could have filled the shoes. And again, maybe less of that sort of, oh, this guy is, I don't know, replacing Roth. But maybe that's totally wrong.
You know, Billy Squire, I think now is the number one most sampled artist by hip hop. So he's rolling in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think in 1985, if Van Halen had asked Billy Squire to join, I think he would have, too, which is
I think he
interesting
probably would have
to think
too.
About, yeah.
I mean, I think it would have been crazy not to not to join. So who did you have, or do you want me to keep going?
Well, one I came up with, who I don't know if he would have done it or not, was David Johansen. And he would have been 35. He would have been 35 then. Sammy was 38. And in 1984, he had a synth album called Sweet Revenge, which I kind of like. But, you know, then after that, Buster Poindexter didn't happen until 1987. So at the time they were looking, he was totally available. I don't know if he would have done it or not, but he could have been a pretty interesting replacement for Roth.
Yeah. Yeah, that is interesting to think about. I mean, I bet he wouldn't have done it, but...
Yeah, probably not. And another one I came up with that I like a lot is Michael DeBar, and he would have been 37, so he... And he had just come out of Checkered Past, which was like a supergroup with Steve Jones and the rhythm section from Blondie, but he had been in Silverhead, who they seem like one of the exact kind of bands that Van Halen would have covered in their early days. And Checkered Past broke up in 85, and then he ended up, Michael DeBar ended up in Power Station, but only for a few months, I think. He just played with them live, but, so he was in a career transition right then, and I think he would have worked really well. He would have been a lot more similar to David Lee Roth.
High boy, high boy.
But the one thing about Michael DeBar is I don't know how a British frontman for Van Halen would have gone over with people. And he's one of those singers who his accent kind of comes through in his right. singing. So hearing him sing the Roth songs, but he was also an actor and everything, so he could have probably just gotten rid of the accent if he wanted mm-hmm. to and sang the Roth songs. But I think he could have been a pretty interesting choice. And he would have been reasonably unknown. I mean, by the average person wouldn't have had any idea who he was.
No, yeah, it's always interesting, you know, to look back to what it was like as a teenager. I mean, you know, I don't know how typical I was as a teenager, but, you know, to me, I didn't have a very deep understanding of what classic rock was like. In other words, if Steve Marriott had been Van Halen's new singer, I would have been like, who's that?
Yeah, right.
Right now, you know, because Humble Pie wasn't part of, at least in my world, the culture of what it meant to be a teenager who liked 70s rock. You liked Yes, you liked Sabbath, you liked Zeppelin. You know, you liked more of the obvious and important bands that sort of soared above the pack. And where Humble Pie, of course, is huge, and I love Humble Pie now, but I would have been like, yeah, I don't know who this Steve Marriott guy is, but he's got a good voice.
Yeah, well, and the same thing is, well, and when I first heard about Sammy Hagar joining Van Halen, I probably didn't know what Montrose was either.
Right.
I know I had a magazine back in the 80s that was like the 100 greatest heavy metal albums of all time. I remember that had like Montrose and Stars in there, and that's where I first right. started reading about stuff like that. But that was probably after
right.
this. So I probably had no idea what Montrose was at the time. And if you think about it, if we were sitting here doing a podcast in an alternate reality about who they could have gotten instead of Michael DeBar, one of us very well might have said Sammy Hagar, the guy from Montrose, you know?
Right. So, yeah, he would have been great. He would have been perfect. Right. The other name that got bandied about quite a bit, I apparently considered, but never, I don't think he ever auditioned, was Jimmy Barnes, who I only had heard him from, I want to say, the Lost Boys soundtrack.
Yeah, did he did the Easy Beat song with INXS, Good Times.
Right, and that's where my whole connection with who Jimmy Barnes is. I've gone back and listened to a little bit of his stuff, and I think he could have been, again, he's an Australian, right? I think, again, that might have been a little bit of a weird cultural shift to have an Australian guy fronting Van Halen, but another good voice.
Yeah, he was in Cold Chisel, who were a huge band in Australia, and they were great. Right. And then in the early 80s, he had some solo albums. I think he was on Geffen, same as Sammy Hagar, I think. Jimmy Barnes is great. But, yeah, that would have been a kind of strange choice, I think. But, yeah, I mean, supposedly, it says on Wikipedia, so it must be true that they considered him for it.
No, I mean, I think I remember hearing that back at the time.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I think I remember, like, Eddie doing interviews, and they said, who else did you consider? He said, oh, not many people. We had some names we threw around, but we didn't audition anybody or whatever. I mean, I actually would love to ask Patty Smyth if she actually ever sang with them. I'm going to guess she probably did.
Yeah.
Because I think she was, you know, she's married to John McEnroe now, and John McEnroe was friends with Eddie, and there was this whole whatever was going on in their social circle there, but I think she was around. And then Eddie played live with Scandal at least twice, because there's two radio broadcasts that are around where he went on stage with them. So, I mean, I would have to imagine that at some point she may have gone up and sang with them. I just think it would have been, I just think she's got a great, great rock voice.
Yeah, and Goodbye to You is a great song. I love that song.
Did you have another name?
I have two more that I really like. Yeah.
All right.
First is Michael Monroe.
Oh, yeah.
And so Razzle was killed in December of 84 in Vince Neil's car, and then Hanoi Rocks fell apart in 85, so he would have been ripe for the plucking, and he was only 23 years old then, and he could have totally pulled off the Roth era stuff.
Oh, definitely. That's actually a really interesting idea. I mean, I think great singer, great look.
Yeah.
And had been through Bob Ezrin as a producer and stuff like that. So definitely wouldn't have been somebody who would have been a novice when, you know, coming to the, even if he wasn't famous in America, he was, you know, he was someone who had worked with top person like that. Yeah. I mean, that's a really interesting idea. I mean, I think he would have been a good possibility there, I think, but
yeah. And he would have brought some edge to it and some more vitality.
Yeah.
I
don't think Michael Monroe would have thought, how would I know when it's love? Would have been a good lyric. I think he would have been like,
right.
No, we're not going to do that.
Yeah. And then probably my favorite idea, but this one is a stretch to make the timeline work, would be Dee Snider. No. So, I mean, obviously, Twisted Sister were coming off of huge success in 84 with Stay Hungry, but in 85, they came up with Come Out and Play, which was kind of a dud.
Right.
And then the tour for that was a notorious disaster.
Right.
And basically, in 85, the band was falling apart. So by the end of 85, when they were recording 5150, I think it's... I mean, it's a stretch, but it's possible that Dee Snider, he was probably ready to get out of Twisted Sister. It was definitely the band was in trouble, I think. And
yeah.
The next Twisted Sister album was Love Is for Suckers, was actually begun as a Dee Snider solo album. So it probably wouldn't have happened, but I think it's at least possible that he would have considered it. And I love the idea of Dee Snider joining Van Halen.
Well, he would have had that blonde floppy hair. So
yeah, right.
Like one mop head after another.
Yeah.
So fine.
But the other name that I saw that has surfaced in later years is that Eric Martin apparently got a phone call from somebody saying you should go try out, but then didn't try out, which I don't quite understand how that works, where he said he chickened out or something like that. I don't know, but this is a Mr. Big, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, he had the Eric Martin Man. I think that album came out in like 83, maybe. Sucker for a Pretty Face. That's pretty good. And then then there was like a self-titled, I'm not sure what year that might have been like 85. But, I mean, yeah, obviously this was before Mr. Big even formed. So definitely, yeah, I wonder why he wouldn't have gone to that. That's weird.
There's an interview kicking around the web.
He's a much more similar singer to Sammy Hagar than anyone else we've talked about. But
And I think if Eddie was trying to write more melodic songs, I think Martin would have been good for that. And again, the thing I've been trying to argue here is that if you bring in somebody who's more of an unknown, it would have been less of this sort of, I think people would have felt less turned off by the whole Roth Van Halen rivalry, right? Because I don't think it would have been as, Sammy would have been as defensive and Roth would have been as defensive. Like, I think, I don't know, but maybe, but I find it hard to believe, like I said, that Roth would have felt threatened by Eric Martin.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it sort of gives that fresh, that's what I was trying to say about Deep Purple to you, sort of bring in these two relative unknown guys to replace Ian Gillan, and it gives it a fresh start rather than just sort of, oh, this is the guy who had the, he's the I Can't Drive 55 guy.
So would you agree that now, looking back on it, the quality of the of Van Halen material with Roth is just miles, miles better than the quality of what they did with Sammy Hagar. Would you agree with that? Or?
Yeah, I would. And I'd preface that by saying to all the people out there listening who like Hagar era Van Halen, I mean, it's a taste issue, right? It's like, do you like Pepsi or Coke? What do you like? You know, I think there's that. But also, I just think that those albums have held up better. I mean, people, I say that to people and they get mad sometimes. And I'm not trying to trash Sammy. I mean, again, I went to the concerts. I bought the albums. But I just think they've held up better. I just think that lyrically and the music, I just think for me, what I enjoy as Van Halen, I prefer the Roth era material. It's just, it's hard for me to say Van Halen 2 is a worse album than OU812. I can't go there, right?
There's just no comparison. They're not even in the same universe.
Women and Children First is a weaker recording overall than Balance.
No, to me, they're not even in the same universe. And yeah, like you said, it is a matter of taste. But I don't know if I don't know how you could look at the songs on the Van Hagar albums and even compare them to the songs on the earlier albums. I just don't see even any remote comparison. Like I said, it's a different universe to me.
Well, that circles back to what we had said earlier. I mean, again, if they had called it Van Hagar and said, we're continuing on the three core members of Van Halen, we're continuing on together, but this is a new band. And they did say that, but I think it would have provided more of a break. And maybe they would have been freed up not to play Jump. I mean, right? And so I personally don't think there would have been a tremendous number of people by 1988 going, oh, they didn't play Jump. I'm so disappointed.
Yeah,
seeing Van Hagar, right? And I think they would have done just as well commercially. I think that was the Warner Brothers bean counters, and probably the brothers too wanting to say, you know, basically F you to Roth. We're not changing our name because of you. You know, I think the Warner Brothers executives, like you said, probably would have had a heart attack if they changed the name, because you're thinking, you know, it's like changing the name of Coke or something like that, or Ford. You know, you can't change it. It's an iconic brand. We can't change that. But I think it would have made less of a mess going forward. And again, I think that was, to me, you know, I saw videos of Sammy in 2004 on stage with Van Halen. Eddie's out of his mind, right, on drugs or drunk, whatever it is. It's a disaster where he's performing. And then Sammy's signing autographs during You Really Got Me. And part of me says to myself, you know, I do appreciate the fact that Sammy seems to be a decent human being overall. Like, if I was going to go hang out with somebody and you were like, who can you hang out with? You know, knowing that, do I want to spend an hour with somebody? I might choose Hagar over Roth, meaning because I think Hagar would treat me like a person. Do you understand what I'm saying? Not knowing what mood Roth was in or whatever. You know, I appreciate the fact that Hagar seems to be sort of, you know, concerned about the fans and what, you know, that type of stuff. I get that, right? But, you know, again, it's like he's signing autographs instead of focusing on singing You Really Got Me. Like, why are they playing it? Don't play it, right? Just don't play it. Play Top of the World. Play Runaround. Play In and Out. Play something else. But don't play the Roth material if you don't want to sing it.
Well, somebody told me a story. I can't remember who it was. Somebody in New York, they had been in a bar. They were in a bar and David Lee Roth was in there. And they just said he was the coolest guy. He was so funny and so nice and just sat there shooting the shit with people. And I always thought David Lee Roth was really funny. And, you know, I think it's a case of laughing with him, not at him. You know what
right.
I mean? And
right.
And I always thought he was really just funny and fun to watch and fun to listen to. And you know, he had a lot of shtick going on there, but I always liked it.
Oh, I mean, yeah, a tremendous sense of humor. And again, that's what I was trying. It just seems to me that, yeah, you just don't know what you're always going to get with certain people. And I, you know, maybe Sammy's one of these guys who kicks dogs and is mean to small children behind closed doors.
Sammy does come across as a really nice guy. Like, I've heard him on Howard Stern and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like, I bet from Sammy's perspective, he's up there with Eddie in 2004. He knows that Eddie is completely out of his mind on drugs and drunk, like insane, right? Like the worst possible condition to be on stage.
Yeah.
And he's probably thinking, I want to make sure these people have a memorable show, so I'm going to sign their program. And I don't begrudge him from doing that. But part of me is like, he's doing it in part because he doesn't want to sing the Roth song, right? So he can sort of, like, he can do something else. And yeah, just don't do that. I mean, that's, again, what I was, you know, trying to get at here is like, bring in Patti Smyth and then say, we're not going to do Panama anymore. I don't know. Just, we're not going to do it. And just move on.
Another thing I had thought about is if I took, say, my 9 favorite Sammy Hagar solo songs, that album would be light years better than 5150 as well, in my opinion.
So is that excluding the 2 Montrose albums?
Yeah, just like Sammy's solo era stuff. Like, I think Your Love Is Driving Me Crazy is a great song. And I always loved Give to Live, too. I remember I bought the cassette single of that song back then.
Yeah.
I think Give to Live is great. He definitely has 9, at least 9 songs that I like a lot.
Yeah, Eagles Fly.
And then, I mean, there's not much about 5150 that I like, so...
Alright, so I hope you enjoyed that. It's always fun to talk to Greg. We'd love to hear your feedback. rockandorrollpodcast@gmail.com or rockandorrollpodcast.blogspot.com, and there's a link at the blog for the Facebook page. If you haven't already, go click like on the Facebook page so you can keep tabs on what's going on with the show. And you can give me feedback on Facebook. That's an easy way to contact me as well. And now, to play us out...
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with a song by HSAS, which was Sammy Hagar, Neil Schon, Kenny Aronson, and Michael Shreve on drums. Michael Shreve had been in Santana, I believe, with Neil Schon. They put out one record in 1984 called Through the Fire, and this is basically... I think it's the last thing Sammy did before joining Van Halen. So this is a song from that record by HSAS, Through the Fire. Great song called Missing You. Until next time.
I'll be back.